Welcome to Season 2 of 52 Reasons Why, the podcast brought to you by Protect Minnesota. Here, we look at the issue of gun violence and explore solutions that will reduce gun death in our state. We're using this platform to bring you a variety of perspectives and voices from across the state of Minnesota, all advocating for gun violence prevention. This podcast is a tool to help decision makers and stakeholders throughout our communities make informed decisions that will mitigate this public health issue. This is for the survivors of gun violence. This is for our loved ones that have been ripped from our lives. This is for the supporters, the volunteers, and the frontline workers who give selflessly and tirelessly to the movement. Thank you for tuning in and showing your support for gun violence prevention. I'm Ayolanda, the Director of Community Response and Education for Protect Minnesota.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of 52 Reasons Why, the Protect Minnesota podcast. I'm Jared Muskovitz, your Outreach and Organizing Director. Happy to be back here in Season 2. And to start our Season 2 off, we are continuing our series with candidates for Hennepin County Attorney. Now, if you've listened to our last couple episodes, we were able to interview Ryan Winkler and Mary Moriarty, who are also running. And today, I am thrilled to be able to be joined by another contender in this race, another candidate for this race, Saraswati Singh, who is running for Hennepin County Attorney. Ms. Singh, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. How's it going today for you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Awesome. Glad. We're really glad to have you here. I've done my research on you, a little background to make sure, to learn about you and your history working in the legal system. But I think what would be best, I always like to start off this way. Tell us about you. Tell us, tell the voters who you are, what you've done, and why you're trying to make this leap to Hennepin County Attorney. We'd love to hear it.
Sure. So I'm running for Hennepin County Attorney, which is to be the top prosecutor for Minneapolis and the surrounding area. So it covers about 1.3 million people. And I'm a prosecutor. I handle murder, sexual assault, domestic assault cases, everything in between. I work a lot with victims and survivors, including the family members of gun violence. I see it as my duty to give voice to the victims that aren't alive to advocate for themselves. And actually, that's what got me really passionate about gun violence and stopping it, because when you see it up close and the ramifications, I've never seen any case where there was a good reason to kill someone. And the aftermath is so sad, so difficult, with so many kids left behind. I want to do everything in my power to prevent any other person in this county and frankly this country from going through that. Some things are better left not experienced.
Absolutely. So you're currently, you said, prosecutor with Ramsey County, right?
Correct. So I work in Ramsey County, which is right next door to Hennepin. It's the second largest county in Minnesota in terms of population. I used to work in Hennepin County for years, so I know the people, the cases, the courtroom. I have a long history. I used to work at the Minnesota Attorney General's office as well. Oh, wow. So I used to work in the public safety divisions, and I went to all around the state. So Minnesota has 87 counties. I went to 62. I handled both criminal and civil cases, both at the district court level and appellate level. I've also worked at the U.S. Attorney's Office handling civil rights cases, and the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, the job I'm vying for to be the top prosecutor there, you do both criminal and civil. So I have both the criminal and civil background. I've even worked at legal aid. So I have an administrative law background as well.
Wow.
And I am experienced. I purposely got experience so that I'd be more than qualified for the job. And I'm running because I care. Plenty of people, they say the right things, but then I don't see it implemented. And so I'm running because I don't see other people doing it. So I'm going to go ahead and do it myself.
That's the reason. That's a good enough reason. That's a great reason. I mean, there's lots of good reasons to get involved, but to want to be an active agent of change because I fully, when you say, you talk about hearing people say, well, all the right things, talk about what we need to be doing. We've been talking about these things, the solutions to gun violence, root causes for seems like my entire life. But we're still talking about it. So yes, we need people who are willing to not only talk, but also make good on those promises and do the tough, gritty work that it's going to take. And what better to have someone than with, you know, a breadth of experience in the legal arena. So that's really, really great. You know, you said you've, you know, obviously you mentioned your experience now, civil experience, criminal experience. It sounded like about 3/4 of the counties you've worked in, which just as a side note for me as an organizer and someone who's worked on campaigns, like getting to all the counties in a statewide race is like a really big deal. So like you're just doing Hennepin County, but you've already, you know, hit most of them, which I think is really cool. You know, in your work now through Ramsey County, Hennepin County, legal aid, everywhere you've been, my guess is that there have been things that have popped up in cases that you've worked, similarities between different kinds of cases when it comes to what were the root causes that drove this act of gun violence. We know things like lack of education, lack of access to equitable healthcare, lack of access to, or lack of family support, lots of different reasons. But, you know, what are the things that you've seen in your work as a prosecutor that you believe are root causes to gun violence, and how would you want to address them in this role as Hennepin County Attorney? What are the things that you think we could do and accomplish to prevent gun violence from happening, right? Because that's what we need to do. Too often we focus on the aftermath, and there are a lot of great groups that are doing important work with trauma care and with this incredible, really critical part of this whole puzzle. But ideally, we would prevent gun violence. We would stop it before it starts. So that's what we talk about. That's what we're talking about with root causes. So what are the root causes that you think we could fix, that we could invest our time and money in to make our community safer?
Yeah, and that's a really great question. When you talk to prosecutors, judges, even defense attorneys, you see some of the same things over and over again. And what are some of the things that you see? You see that kids are growing up in an unsafe environment at home, right? So there's violence at home. Many times it's domestic assault and no one comes in to stop it. And sometimes it extends to child abuse. So the assault on the one parent on another potentially extends to a child. Another factor is lack of structure. So some people just blame parents, and I don't think that's fair, because some parents are working 2-3 jobs just to make ends meet and make rent. And sometimes kids don't have a healthy and safe and structured place to spend their time after school. And so they hang out with people that don't have the child's best interest in mind. And that's part of the reason why, when I'm Hennepin County Attorney, I plan to continue to advocate at the state legislature for after school programs, because there's a reason why people move to the suburbs and want programming for their kids, because it helps, right? To make sure the child is developed, learning, being cared for. And when they do something that's not good, it's addressed immediately, rather than no adult knowing about it for a long time until something really serious, a crime happens. You want to address concerning behavior right away. And so there's the violence that occurs at home. There's a lack of structure and lack of healthy environments. And then during the pandemic, what we've seen is we've had kids that haven't gone to school for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's crazy, right?
It really is. I'm a former teacher, and I, as tough as this is, the pandemic has been, and you know, I am so glad that I wasn't teaching. You know, the last couple of years, I've been fortunate to be with Protect. I can't even imagine being a teacher or being a parent with young children in the last couple of years, and the balance between wanting to get their kids to go to school, but also to be safe with the pandemic. I mean, and then the added stress of childcare, of not being able to have childcare, of needing technology, right, to do school at home. Not everyone can afford to get the webcam or the laptop, and not every school district can just give a student a Chromebook. You know, not every student district has the money they need to do that. So yeah, I just wanted to echo that a bit, because I think this, the consequences of COVID, this is where I think we're going to see this, these long-term effects, right, on this generation of kids that have not been able to experience school in the way that we did, the way we kind of took it for granted, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because I mean, I would have never envisioned something like that happening growing up, because usually you just know who's not in the classroom. And if you're a teacher with 28 Zoom boxes, right, it can be harder to keep track. And you might think, oh, they just moved to a different district, not realizing the kid's just not going to school. And when you don't have kids in the classroom in person, you also don't notice certain things, like if someone is exhibiting mental health issues, that their behavior is changing, that they're using substances, that's causing change in their behavior. And when you're not able to notice it and address it right away, those things can exacerbate. Many times the cases that I see and the people in terms of defendants that I see, we ask, why didn't anyone do anything earlier? Because by the time we see so many folks that have committed a crime, so many things went wrong and there were so many chances to stop it. And now you're here at this end point, and sometimes it is a murder case.
Yeah.
And you're like, what choice do we have? This is a serious public safety issue. But did we need to end up at this point in the first place? And I think we need to not just talk about that more, but do something. We're noticing in the last 2 years, violent crime has increased. I don't think that's an accident. We can take active steps to decrease crime. We have to do it. And I think it's worth trying, because there's just so many people that have been hurt or killed. And I mean, these are people in our community. And the perpetrators that we see in the courtroom, I prefer them not to be there, not to commit the crime in the first place, right? So let's address the root causes by making sure that they have healthy and safe homes, healthy and safe places to go after school, making sure they're getting a good education. And I'm a big fan of paying teachers a very good wage. And
absolutely,
it's troubling how much we ask them to do, and how little we pay them. And then making sure we provide mental health professionals in the school, because goodness, I think everyone's been struggling pretty much during this pandemic. And if adults are struggling, what do you think kids whose brains are still developing are going through? I also think another root cause, we don't talk about this much, but I think it's sexism.
Interesting. I'd love for you to expound on that. Yeah, that's definitely not one that comes up a lot, but I think I know where you're going here, and I definitely agree.
So in our American history and law, we've treated women in particular as property.
Yep.
We've also treated Black people as property. And the laws have changed within the last 100 years about women. They can vote now. I can vote now. Things like that.
People forget it's only been a little over 100 years. It's a bit in the United States, of course, but that's not a long amount of time, people. That is it's a very short amount of time in the larger arc of human history. That's really, we shouldn't be super proud of the 100. We need to be like, let's look back at 1,000 years and look, actually be proud of it. But yeah, it's 100 years.
And because women were considered property, that meant other people could control them and their bodies. And I think it's permeated in different ways throughout society that we don't even notice. But for example, we see so many domestic assault cases. I didn't realize how many we had until I started working in the court system a little over 10 years ago. because I thought this is the United States. That's like more of a third world problem. We used to use that word back when I was growing up. And we have so many cases where the victims are women. And during the pandemic, domestic assault skyrocketed.
Yeah.
I have so many cases. I'll only talk about my close cases. I had so many cases where a defendant would pick up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 felony domestic assault cases.
Wow.
The type of the behavior in those cases escalating, using certain terms that were gendered. And we just see so much of that. And it really stands out because you just see so much of it regarding a particular gender. And there are stats, and I would have to look at the latest stats, but they say, I think it's like the fifth time an officer responds in a domestic assault, the victim is more likely to be not alive by that point.
Wow.
I would double check on the stats, but it's domestic assault cases are really serious. And I think people don't realize just how many murders during the pandemic, they're from domestic assault incidents.
Yeah.
And that's why I say sexism. I think we need to talk about that. Every person is a full person. They're human. They have a right to have control over their bodies and their lives. And you can't just shoot at them. You can't just strangle them. You can't just kill them. And I think that's part of addressing the root cause, because so many women are missing and murdered, especially in the Indigenous community. And I think we need to talk about that and how being advocating for not being sexist actually helps not only your kids, but the whole community, and encourages better behavior. Even when someone's really angry and at their worst, just encourages better behavior, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's so well said. You absolutely nailed it. You know, the domestic violence, intimate partner violence, it's absolutely shot up through the pandemic, as you know, in particular women. The vast majority of domestic violence cases are targeted towards women. During the pandemic, nowhere to go, no way to escape that surrounding at all. I mean, actually unsafe for your well-being to leave, and then you have to stay in the place where you are definitely not safe. And yeah, I think that's a really important part. I think, and we think about intimate partner violence, domestic violence, and then you throw at easy access to a firearm or an unsecured firearm in the home, and it's just a recipe for disaster that we have seen play out. Just, I mean, more times, far more times than is should be accepted, but just an incredible amount of times. And like you said, those lives are lost, and we can't get them back. We can only try to prevent more of these cases from happening in the future. So I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think you're right. That's a part of the argument that I think has been talked about in the past, but has been buried by other things that have emerged, you know. And we definitely don't want to miss that part of it. And when you talk about it really struck me when you mentioned, you know, it's a fact that the laws in our country in the past have ensured that people of color and women were treated as property. I think your comment brought me right to a book called The Second by Professor Carol Anderson, who essentially argues that the Second Amendment is a product of slavery and is reinforcing racial inequality, and it's a really interesting read. But I think when we have to keep those perspectives in mind, the historical injustices just don't go away because you make an amendment. You know, you have to change, the culture has to change too. And we are obviously dealing with, you know, a massive culture shift in the last couple of years when it pertains to police gun violence as well. And I know that you noted that on your website, that it's something you want to keep, you know, police officers accountable, but also, you know, understanding the role that they play in crime prevention. I wonder if you could speak just a little to that, because of what a hot topic it is, and that, you know, we live in Minnesota, we are at the ape, you know, what happened in 2020 with the murder of George Floyd, you know, it made national news for a reason. It was a horrific, horrific event. So And, you know, you're as Hennepin County Attorney, that's your county. That's what you would be working on. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that dynamic and what, how you want to approach it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking that question. I think police accountability is actually a public safety issue. We don't talk about it in those terms, but I'll tell you why I think about it in those terms. When an officer like Chauvin murders a citizen, an American, someone in our community, that's violence. And he had a gun on him. He was on duty as a police officer. And we want officers to be trusted so that when people are willing to call for help when they need it. And something that we noticed, that I noticed, is that after Chauvin did what he did, we had so many people that were scared to call police, even though they needed help, even though they were in a violent situation and they needed help. We also had all these cases where, these are closed cases that I'm talking about only, where the witnesses, we need the witnesses to come in and testify usually at trial, right? Because I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a defendant committed a crime. You need the witnesses many times. And if a witness doesn't come in because they're scared, because they don't trust us, because they think we're like Officer Chauvin, many times we'll have to dismiss the case because we cannot proceed without this important witness. And I don't want to do that. Most prosecutors don't want to do that. And I spend a lot of time the last few years talking with witnesses and victims, saying, just building that trust back, sometimes for the first time. And I think it's really important to hold police accountable, just like you would of a person from any profession.
Yeah.
I'm a lawyer. The Minnesota Supreme Court holds us as a profession accountable. And they will increase the penalties depending on the frequency and the type of violations lawyers commit. That's the same thing you want for officers. And what I'd like to do is hold police accountable, and not just by charging them in a case like Chauvin when he murdered George Floyd, but addressing things right away and talking with the officer. And so, like, if they're, for example, going through a mental health issue or going through a divorce and their anger is coming out in ways that are just absolutely unprofessional, unacceptable, or illegal, we're addressing it right away before they encounter other members of the community. And the Department of Human Rights of Minnesota came out with a report after evaluating the Minnesota, the Minneapolis Police Department. The Hennepin County Attorney's Office works with many police departments. The Minneapolis Police Department is just one. And they found that, for example, officers were using the N-word, calling Black people monkeys, using certain terms for Hispanic people. All of that reduces trust.
Yeah.
First, it's wrong on its face, but it reduces trust and it reduces the chances that someone will call police for help because they don't see us, the police, as someone that's safe to go to. And they're less likely to work with prosecutors because they see us as part of the same system, even though we're different entities and we have different obligations. So I think it's really important to hold police accountable, just like you would anyone else. And I think it will cause people to cooperate more in trials for prosecutors, which is important. So helping put people away that need to be put away because they are a serious threat to public safety and there's no other recourse. And also, so we can help people that need it, because I mean, that's what I love about my job, that I can advocate for people that many times couldn't afford a lawyer like me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really well said. I think noting this idea that, you know, it's not just, I think it's really well said, you know, this idea that, you know, bringing up this, the witnesses, right? The fear of possible retaliation or retribution from someone because you testified, and then the person who committed that crime is just gets to walk, because again, you wouldn't want to try to, you know, run the case through if you're not going to have a chance to win it, because, you know, like, you can't try them twice, like, you know, if you get new evidence. So That's a really good and really important point. You know, we build that trust early, but that has a ripple effect all the way through the legal system that can lead to better outcomes and you know, a safer community. That's really, really important. And I'm glad we were able to talk about it. I want to close, of course, you know, this is a series on restorative justice. And I like to save this for the end because it's a really open-ended question and people have different ideas of what is or isn't effective restorative justice. But this idea that we have to balance a desire for an immediate response to crime and for criminals to be held accountable, but also that we need to rehabilitate, that too often offenders are just punished and are not actually rehabilitated into someone who can thrive and function in society and not reoffend, or not, we see, you know, people who leave prison and then they take their own life because they can't function on the outside. These are things we need to prevent. We have the resources and we know what can work. So as Hennepin County attorney, as someone who would be in that role, and also as your role just now as a, you know, prosecutor doing the similar kind of work, you know, what are your thoughts on restorative justice? How would you seek to implement those ideas and those methods into, you know, the justice system?
Sure. So my priorities are public safety, police accountability, and racial equity, and all three at the same time, because I don't think you can have safety and justice without addressing all three.
Absolutely.
I have three other pieces to my platform too. One of them is privacy rights. I'm pro-choice, pro-interracial marriage, gay marriage. But another important piece is restorative justice. And some people might think, oh, how does that fit in? You handle murder, sexual assault, domestic assault cases. Why would you want to do restorative justice? Well, it's because of what we talked about earlier. Most people don't show up first time on a murder case, right?
Yep.
It usually is a long history of engaging in violent and increasingly more violent behaviors. And I'm a big fan of diversion. There's pre-charge diversion and post-charge diversion. Different people use different terms, but I'm going to use these terms because that's what I use in my office.
Yeah.
So what is pre-charge diversion? That means that an officer responds and we have a crime that's been committed. And usually it's nonviolent, but it's concerning, right? And what does diversion do? We say, okay, we're not going to charge you, but we're going to do an in-depth evaluation. And so they do an in-depth evaluation of that particular person. And then they come out with a report identifying specific things that the person must do, which addresses the root causes of their concerning behavior. And that person has to agree to do it in order to stay in diversion. And if they do all those things, then our office does not charge them. Now, some people think, oh, that's too lenient. That's letting people off the hook. No, because what happens if they don't do all those things? And those are not like, oh, just, you know, pet your dog.
Go spend 5 hours at a community center. Just say you were there. Yeah, no, there's actual, you have to do legitimate work on yourself. There are a lot of very, very like time consuming, like elements you have to do. Absolutely. Yeah.
Correct. And so, because many times people will say, I don't have an addiction issue. They have it and they have to take all these steps and it's no joke, you know? Other times it's mental health issues that are beginning to show and saying, nope, you have to get assessed and then you have to take all these steps. We're not going to pretend that you don't have a mental health issue that's beginning to manifest itself. So, and there's other pieces to it. And so if they do all the things that are in that diversion report that they're told they need to do in order to get this benefit, you know, they don't get charged. But if they don't do all the in-depth things, we charge them. That's the consequence. And then they go through the criminal justice system like they would otherwise. But it gives people a chance to address their core issue right away, which is really an important benefit, because the criminal justice system, we have such a backlog. The courts shut down multiple times for months at a time, and we're still not at full strength yet. And so there's this backlog, and many times the when a case does resolve, it's years down the road. And it's better to frankly address the core root issues right away, which is why I'm a fan of diversion for cases where it's not a threat to public safety and they're actually doing that work. I'm also a fan of post-charge diversion. So if we charge a case and the person says, yes, I'm willing to do diversion and I'm willing to take the active steps, and they get a benefit if they do all the steps, okay. They may not have to go and suffer certain consequences because they did all this heavy lifting right away and are not committing new crimes. That's often, you know, you have to remain law abiding. They're not committing new crimes. It's working, right? And so I'm a fan of that. And so I think that's a benefit, because I'm running because I'm concerned about public safety, but I'm also very focused on reducing crime in the first place. And as Hennepin County Attorney, my plan is to focus on both. And I'm a collaborative person, I'm a collaborative leader. And I think restorative justice is a key piece in working on reducing crime from happening in the first place. I have other pieces under the restorative justice, but I also know we have limited time. I'll just quickly say I'm also a big fan of treatment courts, which are, some people think, oh, that's easy. No.
It is not. I've worked a lot of different odd jobs. I went when I was a teacher. I also worked for a time as a tech at a behavioral health facility for those suffering opioid addiction, and often taking people to their court appearances and their court, going to court ordered treatment. And I can tell you, 90-day in-house rehabilitative treatment from opioid addiction is going to be the 90 worst days of your life if that's where you're at. It's not easy in the slightest. And so, but I've seen it work. I have seen people come through on the other side of that because they were given this choice to commit to changing their life before they headed down the path where it was going to be prison or nothing else. So I hear where you're coming from. I think we have to do these things. I think they are an absolute necessity. So to hear you, you know, promote them so strongly, I think is a really good thing to hear.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing your experience, because frankly, a lot of people don't know that. Yeah. And that for treatment court, you have to go to court every week.
Yeah. Usually. Yep.
Normally it's, you go to court once a month, but this is every week being held accountable. The courts, the prosecutor, defense attorney, the social workers knowing everything about you and connecting you to all these resources. Usually it's healthcare, which is so sad that the criminal justice system is really a way to get a lot of people healthcare.
Yeah.
One of the many things you learn when you become a prosecutor and work in this system.
Absolutely. That's, again, a thing people don't, if you're not working in that arena, you're never, it's never going to, something that it's never going to click. It's never going to pop in your head. But as soon as you see it, it all these things start to make sense. Like, oh, that's why we have A, B, C, and D, because all of these things are happening. And yeah, I think, you know, treatment court, for me, at least, again, not a prosecutor, not an attorney in the slightest, but just from the experience I had working at the treatment facility, it seemed to me like it was an opportunity for prosecutors, defense attorneys, everyone, the judges, everyone in the system to kind of work collaboratively in support of bettering this person. And I just think that that is a really unique opportunity for someone to see levels of support from different sides, different avenues, all saying, we're here to help you help yourself. I think that can be really powerful for some people.
And I think that's exactly right. And I think it's also the right approach. We offer treatment court to a number of folks, and many times there's a wait list. But the thing is, the defendant has to be willing to do the work.
Yeah.
And not, some people come and watch, actually plenty of people come and watch, and when they realize what it entails, they're like, I'll go through the regular system. I'm out. I'm not willing to do all that work.
Yeah.
But I think it's just so fantastic because they've been collecting data on these types of programs. They have a higher success rate. And so that means these folks are not committing crime at the rate that they would have before, or they stopped committing those crimes altogether, which I think is really important in crime prevention, keeping our communities safer, and getting that defendant back up and on their feet and a functional member of society, which I think is to the benefit of all of us, because many times they have kids themselves or siblings or parents, you know, they have loved ones too. And so, and the opioid addiction crisis is real. We have treatment court, right? These are most of us know at least one person. So these treatment courts can be a way out for some people where the families are like, I don't know what else to do. I need help. And this is the courts and the system's way of collaboratively addressing these core issues with a defendant who's interested and willing to put in the work. And frankly, it when it works, and it, there's plenty of instances that it does, it's just so rewarding and it's just so joyous, you know?
Yeah, I think back to my days working at the treatment facility, and the days that stick out to me most are when a few clients that we worked with, you know, finished the program and graduated. And just watch them do the 90 days and remember to be the someone who handled their intake, which I would often do, and then be at their graduation. You know, I've never really kind of experienced like seeing someone's humanity grow in that way, but to go through that process and to do the hard work on yourself, that's how you grow as a person. And that's how you, you know, escape the paths you could be heading down. I love that you said that. I think that's really important. I think we always need to be looking to see the humanity in people and understand that the vast majority of people who end up at these points in life just desperately want to better themselves and to not be there anymore. And so to have that option to say you can work, and it's going to be hard, but if you commit yourself and dig deep, we can fix things. I mean, I think we always have to try to do that for people. We could go on for so long. We could keep talking. This has been a wonderful conversation. But just for the purpose of time, of course, we do need to call it. So, Saraswati Singh, candidate for Hennepin County Attorney, currently a prosecutor in Ramsey County. You can learn more about her candidacy for Hennepin County Attorney at her website, SaraswatiSingh.com. She also has her Instagram and Twitter accounts, which is her first name, Saraswati, and then an underscore, and then MN on Instagram and Twitter to find out more about her campaign. The primary election is August 9th. So that's the day where we'll find out. Well, it's a nonpartisan race, correct? So a couple candidates are going to get through to the general. So that's the first step, though. So to learn more about her campaign, as I said, those are her website, SaraswatiSingh.com. Ms. Singh, thank you so much for this really enlightening and really, I think, hopeful and positive conversation. I really enjoyed it. And I think our listeners definitely will as well.
Thank you so much, Jared. I've really enjoyed talking with you. And thank you for continuing to bring attention to this issue. I think more and more people are beginning to care about it, and I'm hopeful that we'll finally have some action. So thank you so much for your hard work.
You're very welcome. This has been another episode of 52 Reasons Why, the Protect Minnesota podcast. I'm Jared Muskovitz, and we will catch you next time. Take care.
Thank you for joining us on Protect Minnesota, the podcast where we explore 52 reasons why gun violence is an issue in our state. If you want to listen to past episodes of the podcast or for more information about how you can be involved in this movement, visit protectmn.org. Until next time.